But this morning, total U-turn, going into Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 and 32. We're continuing in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. In Matthew 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has taken his disciples up onto the mountain, and he is describing to them, or explaining to them, teaching them concerning what life in his kingdom looks like. And life in his kingdom looks a lot different than life in our kingdoms, whether that's kingdoms as nations or even the kingdoms of our own hearts that we create. And in each of the last couple of sections that we've looked at, there's a total of about six of them here in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus adopts kind of this teaching model where he starts with, you have heard that it was said, or you have heard it said, and then he says, but I say to you, so you have this is what you have heard, now this is how I'm reframing it. And in each case, Jesus takes a legal requirement of the Old Testament law, something that was in place for the good of the people of Israel, but he takes it from being just an external expectation and then raises the righteous requirements to include the internal thoughts, motives, and desires of his disciples, right? And so, on the one hand, if he was just talking about externally, we would all feel really great that we haven't murdered anybody. But then Jesus says, well, it's not just murder, it's also the anger. We might say, I'm so glad that, right, that I can breathe easy because I haven't committed adultery. But then he says, but if you looked at anybody with lust in your heart, you have. You go, well, that pretty much eliminates all of us then, right? And we come to this point where we recognize in each case, Jesus is raising the righteous requirements of his kingdom to a place where he is the only one who can fulfill it across the board, right? He's not just saying to you and to me, we need to come together and just try harder. In fact, the whole point of the law was to remind us that we can't try hard enough. We are a people who are completely dependent on what God does for us, not just we will do this for God and then he'll find us acceptable. Rather that, he says, you can't do it, but because of God you can, and then out of a response of what God has already done for you, you live, breathe, act, and have your life. Now I don't know if it's necessarily a disclaimer, but as we come to Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 through 32, we are about to jump feet first into a situation that is alive and well within our culture, and it might be one that is very personal for us. The reality is we're talking about divorce this morning, and depending on what statistic you look at, it says divorce affects 80% of us in some way. I would say it probably affects all of us in some way. Because I'm not going to ask you, but if I asked you, do you know anybody in your life who has been divorced, everybody would say, well, yeah. Whether it's a friend, a family member, or yourself, you go, yeah, I know that. I've seen the impact of that. And what I want to say, just as in terms of just a little, this is a personal disclaimer maybe, is that what we will do this morning cannot possibly exhaustively teach on every possible scenario involving divorce that y'all have encountered. Right? So you might would come to me afterward and say, well, what about this scenario? And we say, well, we want to still apply God's word consistently to every scenario. And yet you might go, well, you didn't really talk about this aspect of it. What we're talking about this morning, though, is Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 through 32, recognizing that we could spend every week talking about, like for the rest of our lives, we could talk about how the gospel applies to our lives and marriage. Right? Like, we're never going to run out of material to talk about how the gospel applies to every aspect of our life, including the difficult topics like divorce. And so it's kind of like, I might speak broadly about divorce this morning, and you might go, well, that doesn't speak to my situation or the situation that I'm aware of. And I would liken it a little bit to when I have six kids. So when four of them are all doing the same activity that they shouldn't be doing, I say, hey, y'all, stop jumping off the couch. And every time, the one that's not jumping off the couch says, but I'm not jumping off the couch. I say, okay, but it's affecting four out of the, like, it's affecting 66% of you. So I'm not going to say you, and you. I'm just going to say, stop jumping off the couch. In the same way, right, you might go, well, I have a different question on that. And hear me on this. There is there is time and space to ask the questions, and I'm completely open to having the conversation. So if you go, you didn't talk about this aspect of it this morning, it's not because I don't think that aspect doesn't exist or that it couldn't possibly be another scenario that requires delicate handling of the word in your life together. So you might go, well, that seems just like a broad shotgun pattern, right? But that's what we're teaching this morning. And so recognizing that, but at the same time, we are going to say to the best of our ability, this is what Jesus is saying. And in some ways, it might step on our toes a little bit, but at the same time, Jesus, if he's going to be the one that steps on our toes, he's also going to be the one that applies the healing afterwards. So Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 through 32. He says, it was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. And Jesus adopts the same kind of starting pattern as verses 21 and 27. It's a little bit shorter. In verses 21 and verse 27, he said, you have heard that it was said to those of old, or you've heard that it was said, and now he just condenses it to, it was also said. And where was it said, or who said it? So just really quickly, Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4. And this is a little bit different than the previous 2 weeks that we've looked at, because the previous 2 weeks, the commands that he were addressing, we would say, well, those are two of the big ones, right? There were two of the Ten Commandments, that you shall not commit murder, and you shall not commit adultery. And now it's like, well, it's still attached to adultery, but the command explicitly in the Old Testament is not listed in the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20. But in Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4, we see God's provision for this within the Old Testament people of Israel. It says, when a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house, and if she goes and becomes another man's wife, and the latter man hates her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter man dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away may not take her again to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord. And you shall not bring sin upon the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance. Now, this is a little bit different because you notice that in Deuteronomy 24 and in Matthew chapter 5, there's a reference to a certificate of divorce. Right? So like it's some sort of legal document that shows the divorce is taking place. And in our day and age, we go, well, that sounds pretty simple, it's pretty standard fare. You go to court, they write you a certificate, you have that. Okay, take off our modern thinking hats and let's go like 5,000 years previously. Right? Writing a certificate or giving a certificate is not something that would just be standard fare within a court system or something like that. But it's also different from just straight adultery. Right? In adultery, under the law, we looked at this last week, in case of adultery, it was a capital offense. Right? So the two parties caught in adultery were brought out in front of the people and they were stoned. In this case, it's just a man who takes a wife and marries her and then she doesn't find favor in his eyes, or he finds some indecency in her. That's a pretty broad category. And it's a little bit of what Jesus is addressing in Matthew chapter 5, and we're also going to look at Matthew chapter 19 in just a minute. But what I want you to start with, when Jesus says, it was said, or you have heard that it was said, what would ping in the minds of his hearers is first, oh yeah, Moses said that. But it actually really isn't necessarily Moses who said that. Like, Moses was the mouthpiece, but where did the command come from? It came from God. So this is God speaking to his people through Moses. Now, it's really important that we stop for a minute and say, if Jesus is saying, you have heard that it was said by God the Father, but I say to you, we have to pause and say, is Jesus disagreeing with the Father? That's a really important big question for us. How many of you have ever heard somebody say, well, the God of the Old Testament is different than the God of the New Testament? Or I say, the God of the Old Testament seems really angry and really vindictive and full of justice, but the God of the New Testament is one of love and grace and mercy, and he's not concerned with all that other Old Testament stuff. So when Jesus is reframing, it raises the question, well, is Jesus disagreeing, or is he saying, well, that's not really true? And I just want to really quickly point out two things to you. Whenever Jesus is doing this, when he's talking and teaching on the Old Testament, first of one, Jesus doesn't dispute what they have heard, but he extends it to a higher degree. So Jesus doesn't say, you have heard that it was said, but really that's a bunch of nonsense. He doesn't say that. He says, you have heard that this was said, but this is really, like, this is the heart behind it. You have heard that it was said, don't commit adultery, but I tell you, like, even the internal, like, what's going on in your mind and through your eyes, that's wrapped up in the external requirement of the law. You have heard that it was said, don't murder people, but I'm telling you, like, the requirement of the law is actually not just, you're not killing somebody. But it starts with, and it involves, the internal, the heart of the person involved. So Jesus isn't disputing what is taught in the Old Testament, but he is extending it from external to internal. And then the second one, I'll invite you to go back and read Matthew chapter 5. We're not going to spend a lot of time in Matthew 5, just dropping a reference for you. In John chapter 5, right after Jesus has healed somebody on the Sabbath, all of the people come and they get really upset with Jesus because they say that he's making himself equal with God, right? So like they're going, well, he's saying that he's God. And we recognize that Jesus is the eternal Son of God who comes in the flesh. But for the first century Jews, they're like, that's blasphemy. But Jesus makes three statements in John chapter 5, or three broad statements about his relationship to the Father that helps us frame this as well. The first one is that Jesus says that he does what the Father does. So Jesus himself does whatever it is that the Father does. So Jesus is not putting himself at odds with God the Father. The second one is he says he does what the Father wills. So he does what the Father does. He does what the Father wants him to do. And then the third thing he says even more strongly is, I do what I was sent to do. So Jesus does what the Father does, he does what the Father wills, and he does what the Father sent him to do. So Jesus places himself, when he teaches in John chapter 5, in a place of complete, in his earthly ministry, in obedience to the Father, not in competition with him. And so I would just say to you, just be aware, when we start to pit the heart of God the Father against Jesus, there's a red flag warning that we are reading the scriptures wrong. When we start to pit Jesus against his Father, because they're eternally one, they're in complete unity with one another. There's no, like, you can't grease the track with the Father to get something that the Son would not give you. In the same sense that you can't ask the Spirit to give you something that the Father or the Son would not give you. They're in complete harmony, complete unity, complete, like, they're one God in three persons, and that'll blow our minds. We can't spend all day on it. But just, I think it's important when Jesus says, you've heard that it was said, he is not saying what God told you was nonsense. But what he is doing is saying, what you are doing in practice in accordance with the law, I'm saying to you, you're still lacking the righteousness that's attached to it. So he's, you go, in Deuteronomy chapter 24, the purpose of the divorce certificate, you see it play out there in Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, is that it would allow a woman who would otherwise be shamed by her culture and unable to, like you said, she would be left destitute. It would provide the means for her to be able to remarry. So if a father, or if a husband hated her and just wanted to be rid of her, it would not ruin her life. It would give her avenues to remarry, keep her from committing adultery. On face value, this seems like, then, pretty easy compared to the issues of anger and lust. Like, okay, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. So I want to take us to Matthew chapter 19, Because we get another parallel passage where a question is asked of Jesus right in the same vein of this. Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 12. We start to see a little bit of potentially some of what was going on in Jesus' day. The Pharisees or the religious leaders come, and verse 3 says, they came up to him and tested him. You know, that's kind of an interesting phrase, testing Jesus according to what? The prevailing thought is that in Jesus' day, there's two main camps of interpretation for the Old Testament, led by a couple of different religious leaders. And one would say that you could divorce your wife for anything. If she cooked a meal that you didn't like, she's out. The other one would say that the divorce is still permissible, but it was more stringent, but it wasn't, it still wasn't as forceful as what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5. And so what they're asking when they're testing Jesus, they're in a sense they're asking him, which camp do you align yourself with? But even more so than that, when they begin to test him, one of the questions that we might say is they're asking how far can we go and still be, from your perspective, within the legal requirements of the Old Testament law. So they come to Jesus and they test him, saying, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any reason? So any reason at all, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? And Jesus answered them, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And he said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. And they said to him, why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away? There's that idea again. So, okay, if you say that, then why did Moses say this was okay? And again, they're looking at Moses, not Moses, the Lord. And he said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. So Jesus teaches the exact same thing here as he says in Matthew chapter 5. And the disciples said to him, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it's better not to marry. But he said to them, not everyone can receive this saying, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let the one who is able to receive this receive it. Now, in just a minute, we're gonna talk about Jesus' response and break it down into three major points. But the question, the overarching question that they ask is, can we divorce for any reason? And so in Matthew chapter 5, when Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, you can provide a certificate of divorce, there's probably a good chance that there's this underlying tone to it. You've heard that you could divorce for any reason. And this semester at the Christian College, I taught a marriage and family class, and so I just thought I would share one statistic with you that was used this week. Maybe two statistics. The first one, in 1860, the U.S. divorce rate was one divorce for every 1,000 marriages. That seems pretty low. And we would go, well, that's because people were trapped in their marriages. They couldn't do anything. In 2013 to 2019, so about a six-year period, that number had risen to 17 per 1,000. And one just completely secular study from a law firm, they surveyed a whole bunch of people. They found that the number one reason why people divorce is lack of commitment. Which is interesting when we consider that marriage is a covenant or a heightened commitment. And the number one reason people would jump out is a lack of that. But I would suggest to you this morning that we have a culture of divorce. When we survey the statistics across our country and we say 50%, right? You hear that one all the time, 50%. 50% of marriages end in divorce. And typically they say it doesn't matter whether you're in church or not. Well, actually, if you're regularly involved, like if you're really involved, which means that you're really probably, and not just by legalism following Jesus, but if those that have a strong relationship with the Lord, it's 1.5 times lower. Having said all that, divorce is all around us and it is rampant. We have adopted a position of no-fault divorce, right? Which means that you can just say two people come to the... You used to. Did you know? Before no-fault divorce, you would have to go and file a claim with a court and say, these are the legal reasons why we should be released from our marriage. Versus now, you just go, we just have these differences. Like, it could be that we squeeze the toothpaste in the wrong spot, but we have differences that we can't get over. They do the toilet paper the wrong way. And you know what the wrong way is? It's when it comes from behind. But anyway. But you could say, so the irreconcilable differences can become just anything that we're not willing to get over, right? And I'm not trivializing the more serious and ramp up of differences that occur. But what I am saying is that we have made the bar in our country and in our culture so incredibly low for marriage and for divorce. And so Jesus' response is important to us because, for one, he doesn't reference anybody's teaching. What he references, the first thing that he references, the first point of his response, is he refers to God's design in creation. In verses 4 and 5, notice this, he says, they say, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason, for any cause? And Jesus doesn't begin with, well, you know, I've really been thinking about this. I've been wrestling through it to get to a personal point of conviction. He says, what is the design? Haven't you heard that this is what God did in the beginning? It says that, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife and the two shall become one flesh. He's directly quoting Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And then he's also directly referencing Genesis chapter 2, verses 23 and 24. I'm including verse 23, but he's directly quoting verse 24. He said, the man said, this is at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, and she shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So when Jesus responds, he says, well, the good design for marriage, that the purpose of marriage is rooted in creation. It's the way that God made it from the beginning. Now, I've not been hunting with a lot of you, but I can say this. If we were out rifle hunting and we went out there and you were bouncing from tree to tree with the barrel in your hands and you're holding your gun like a baseball bat, right, and you were trying to hit a deer over the head with it, I'll say, well, it could be effective, but that's not what it's designed for. That's not how it was made. Now, have you ever tried? It could be. Let's switch gears. Have you ever been working on a house project and you used like a tool that worked, but it wasn't really designed for the thing that you did, and then you found out they made a specialty tool for that, and it's like, wow, that's really easy. Right? And it could be, it's like, well, this is like, I saw my dad use the tool wrong that way, so that's just the way I learned to do it. I didn't even know there was a tool that did it the right way. And Jesus is saying, like, this might be the way you're doing marriage, but this wasn't the design. And you want to have a little mind blower right here? This is the one through whom, for whom, and by whom all things were created is saying, that's not how we made it. The New Testament tells us Jesus is there in creation. He's an active participant in the creative work. And so when he speaks and he says, haven't you heard that he who created them, he might as well say, didn't you know that when the Father and I did this, this wasn't so. This is how we made it. So he roots it in creation. And I want to make a quick point, just a quick clarification here. Because Jesus references, it's in Genesis chapter 1 as well. But when we're talking, first of all, in God's design for marriage, Jesus quotes and he says, he made them male and female. God's design for marriage, first and foremost, is one man and one woman. Who are the one man and the one woman are different by design. They're distinct by design. They're equal in value, but they're not interchangeable. Right? And our culture would tell us the exact opposite. Doesn't it? Like marriage is just two people who are committed to each other. Or, and down the road, don't be surprised when we say, well, it's just a number of people who are committed to each other. But Jesus would say, that's not Right? In our day, people could come and say, Jesus, can a man and a man be married without any problem? And Jesus would say, haven't you heard what it was said in the beginning when God created them male and female? So when you think about this, when we erode our confidence in God's word, like the waging of eroding truth from Genesis 1 and 2 and saying, well, did God really create everything? It leads to then the squishiness of everything else we do in culture. So if God didn't really design, then anything goes. If God's not really the one who authored things, then we can define them by our own definition. But if God did design and God speaks to it and Jesus here speaks to the design that God has made, we are not free to redefine what he has done. And so it's not just any number of committed people to each other, he says, but it's one man, one woman who are created differently, but distinctly, put together for each other's good. And then he says that the two shall become one. So it becomes an exclusive relationship, an exclusive covenant between these two individuals, which is a willfully choosing one another and willfully refusing all others. Male and female, exclusive. But then notice that it's not just a human invention or a human institution. First of all, it's God who created them from the beginning, made them male and female. But then it also says that they're no longer two, but they're one flesh. And then he says, what therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. So it's not just a human institution. It's not just a human invention. Well, that marriage seems like a good social convention, a social thing that works for most cultures, but we think we can do it better now. No, he says, what God has put together, don't let people take apart. That could include people from the outside of the marriage, but it would also include people from inside of the marriage, right? Let nobody tear this thing apart, what God is putting together. Which leads us to a place also of seeing that it's a sacred good gift from God. It's a good gift from God. But how often, let me just be honest, how often do we hear around us broadly in culture, whether it's at work, media, whatever it is, how often do we hear, outside of weddings, how often do we hear marriage celebrated as God's good gift and how it enables human flourishing? Versus, how many times do we hear the negatives of marriage? Not only that, but in Ephesians chapter 5, and we're not, again, not going to go into Ephesians 5, write it down, go back and look at it later. Ephesians 5, Paul says that marriage is it reveals in some way the mystery of the gospel. In other words, it reveals, it's this picture of God and his relationship towards his church, where Jesus lays down his life for the church and the church joyfully submits to and follows him. So it's by design, it's God's good gift in creation, but now even on this side of the fall, it continues to be the best picture that we have living out in front of people, the relationship between God and his people. So Jesus first says, this is God's design. The second thing he says is, divorce is not God's design. Right? So the design of marriage, and then divorce is not included in that design, so not letting anybody separate it out. But then they ask him the question, well, then why did Moses allow this in the law? And I find it, Jesus' answer, one that really, it should hit home with all of us, not just if we have experienced divorce. He said to them in verse 8, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. Again, this isn't part of the design. So they're viewing it as this is the stamp of approval that the law gives to divorce, and Jesus says it's permitted in the law, but it's not the design of marriage. To the contrary, he says it's permitted because of the hardness of the hearts of the people involved. In other words, because of rampant sin and brokenness, people will divorce because of sinfulness. Again, I don't mean this to come heavy, but I think it's what the Word is telling us this morning. I believe we'd be hard-pressed to find examples of divorce that don't involve sin in the lives of one or both parties. I don't necessarily feel like it's a controversial statement, but we don't necessarily like to be told that the divorce that we either have been affected by or been involved in was because of sin. It wasn't because of just irreconcilable differences. It was because of hardness of heart. For every marriage, whether it's intact, whether it has gone through divorce, I want you to, if you're taking notes, just write a capital I. My marriage and your marriage have an I problem. Your greatest, and again, this is broad. I understand that there's other circumstances that might be a little bit different. The biggest problem with your marriage is the person looking back in the mirror at you. But what do we often tell ourselves the biggest problem in our marriage is? If he or she would just do the things that I wanted them to do, if they would just do it my way, if they would just do it this way, if they would just not say things this way, if they would just not chew that way, if they would just not do this, you know what the fun reality of that is? They're looking right back at you thinking the same things. Let me ask you a question, though. What if both parties in a marriage were radically committed to following Jesus and dealing with the sin in their own hearts in relationship to the Lord first? Would it change the way you see your spouse? If my inclination were to change from you to I have done this, how much would that change? Which leads to the last thing. We're going to end in hope, right? That you and I, we're the greatest problem. But in reality, you could extend this out. You go, well, I'm not married. I'm so glad you're not talking to me today. You're also the biggest problem in probably all of your other relationships, right? You have issues, and I don't say that to be funny or to be mean, but you and I, like, this is what the gospel tells us too. Is like, you and I, by ourselves, like, we are irretrievably, irreparably broken. And that affects every other thing that we do. But the good news is that because of what Jesus has done for us, here, like, do not leave without hearing this morning. Because of what Jesus has done for us, not just in bringing us new life through faith in him, will he not, if he's making every provision of his grace for us to grow to maturity in him, is he not also making every provision of his grace for your marriage? Is he not making his resources available to you to walk in them, to see your marriage changed? But how often do we to fall to a spot of like, I don't know, this thing's like, I don't know what could happen with this. If God is doing a transforming work in us individually, will he not extend that into the ripple effect of our marriages? But I would say, so you and I, we're little sandcastle builders. And we want everybody in our lives to build our sandcastle the way we're building it. And we get really upset whenever they kick an extra bit of sand or they touch it where we didn't want them to touch it, and they affect our sandcastle. Right? And we view our marriages as a sandbox, and we might think that we just draw a line straight down the middle of it, and that's your side of the sandbox, this is my side of the sandbox, like, let's build together, and hopefully our sandbox ends up looking like some unique expression of ourselves. But think about this, if God's good design is to gift individuals for one another and for their good, how crazy, like, God has given you, and the words matter here, so God has given you someone to fight with, not somebody to fight against. He has given you somebody to fight alongside of you. He's given you the greatest teammate that you could ever have, outside of himself. But how often do we turn and start to fight against our greatest teammate rather than fighting alongside of them, building alongside of them, removing the line in the sandbox, and building together what we could not build by ourselves. But instead, we turn God's gift into just the old ball and chain, the affliction of my soul. The one who won't give me permission to do this, so I'm just going to do it anyway. Right? Like, fight with, not against. And the last thing that Jesus does in his response is he upholds the value of every marriage between one. And I'm going to clarify that because so nobody rips it out of context. Jesus upholds the value of every marriage, male and female. One male, one female. With one, he gives one exclusion. In both Matthew chapter 5 and Matthew chapter 19, he says, except for sexual immorality. But even then, he doesn't say that divorce is required, but he says, this is the one place it would be permitted. And we could do side discussions on abandonment and abuse and a whole other host of things. But Jesus here says, this is the only one. Not only is divorce not ideal in his kingdom, but it not ought to be among his people, right? Like the value of every marriage is raised high. And what's interesting about this is, I bring it back to something I said last week in terms of lust and anger. No one will come to the place where they're at the judgment seat of Christ and he says, okay, you know, why do you come in? Well, I didn't get divorced. That's not your hope for eternity. Your hope for eternity is not just simply clinging to your marriage. Your hope for eternity is that Jesus died for you, poured himself out for you, died in your place, and gave you life. Right? So while he upholds the value of marriage and not divorce, like your eternal hope in Christ is not built on whether or not you have been divorced. That's really good news. Like, in the same good news that it's our eternal hope is not whether or not we've ever lusted in our heart for somebody, or that we've ever been angry in our heart towards somebody. Right? Our hope is rooted in Jesus, and he transforms our hearts. But the disciples, I love their response, because you would think, like, this is a pretty simple statement from Jesus. Don't divorce, right? But his disciples say to him in verse 10, if this is the case, it would be better not to marry. Life is full of troubles. Like, it would just be better not to get to, like, just don't jump into that. And one of the things that's a little bit terrifying when I meet with people that want to get married, one of the terrifying things is, like, I just want to take you back. Do you remember when you were running up to your marriage, like, a little giddy, infatuated butterfly feelings you had toward your spouse? Like, couldn't wait to get married, couldn't wait to embark on a new life together, couldn't wait to see what would happen. Did you foresee on that day when you said, I do, all of the myriad challenges, waves of life that have hit your marriage and your life since then? And so how do you prepare a couple that's just giddy and like walking on cloud nine, like everything's going to be perfect, and you're like, and you're kind of building it in there. It's actually not going to be. But it's going to be good, and it's going to be enough, and Jesus is going to be in the center of it. Like, Jesus has a good plan for this. It may not be easy. So, like, if you're basing your marriage whether or not it's easy, again, wrong metric. So the disciples essentially say, in a broken world with broken people, who has a chance? Who could possibly live up to this in a broken world with broken people? And Jesus says, like I said, it'd just be better not to marry. And Jesus actually says, like, well, not everybody can do that, actually. There are some who are called to this life of singleness, but it's not for everyone. So he doesn't just say, yeah, you're right, run away from marriage as fast as you can. He says, for some, God will give grace for this, but for others, he's going to give grace for marriage. As we close, I'm going to invite Jason. She's just going to come up and provide you a little bit of thinking music. I just want to, as we get ready to turn our attention to the Lord's table, I want to ask us to do a little bit, maybe more heart work on ourselves before we come to the table than we normally do. Because the other aspect of this, and I hope you hear this too, is that being not divorced does also not equal valuing and cherishing your spouse. Right? Just the very fact that you haven't divorced doesn't mean you value and cherish your spouse the way you ought to. So maybe you're not divorced, but in your heart of hearts, you know you're neglecting your spouse. You're devaluing your spouse. You're not honoring of your spouse. Whether it's in the way that you act towards them or the way you speak about them, whether to them or to others. Maybe not just in marriage, but in an aspect of life, you'd say making life about your kingdom, your sandcastle. And as you reflect, I just invite you to think about this question. You can get kind of in your happy little quiet place, just you and your thoughts for a minute. You want to bow your head and think about this. Hard question. What have you been contributing to your marriage mess? What is the I issue? Maybe there's one that you just go, wow, this is my heart. This is me. What are you even bringing into the mess? Maybe this morning, you're sitting here in a room full of people and you think you're the only one that's in a messy marriage. And give you a little bit of hope, you're not. Every marriage is messy. I encourage you and ask the Lord in this regard, fight for the marriage and the spouse that God has given you, not the one you wish you had. And see what God might do in transforming it, but fight for your marriage and fight for your spouse to the glory of the Lord. And maybe I'm leaving you out and you say, I'm not married, so I don't know what I'm supposed to do with what you just said about any of this. First of all, if it's the Lord's desire down the road for you to be, prepare now by abiding in Christ. What do you need to do? You still have an eye problem. Playing out in every aspect of life. What does it look like to submit to the Lord in every area? That's not just a question for the unmarried. But also, maybe you're single, maybe you're widowed. What does it look like for you to support the marriages around you? To speak life and encouragement and the hope of the gospel into those around you? That could go for those of you that are married. That could go for those of you that are single as well. This morning, as we begin to start to turn our attention towards the table, I encourage you, can you see the hope that is there for your life, your marriage, your family, because of what Jesus has done for you? This morning, as we're getting ready to eat and drink, we are being reminded that we aren't enough, we're not good enough, we can't do X, Y, or Z enough, but our hope rests in the fact that Jesus came for us, lived the perfect life that we couldn't live, died the death we deserved to die, and was raised to life so that we might be raised to new life with him. That is our hope. And I encourage you, as you've been doing work with the Lord this morning, and I pray that you have, that you would also talk with your spouse about these things after you leave this morning. Maybe there's some hard work of confession of things that you have placed, unrealistic expectations or ways that you have contributed to the mess. Own your part of it. Don't own the stuff that's not yours. But would you together turn and seek the Lord and fight with each other, not just against each other?